You are listening to the Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, where we discuss myth, math, spirituality, philosophy, and much, much more. www.thesyncbook.com. Greetings once again, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining me. The whole point of this show is to highlight people who I've personally been influenced by, and I've been really looking forward to the show ever since I booked it, and you are all in for a real treat as this episode is just jam-packed full of nuggets of truth and wisdom. Before we get started, I just want to thank all the people who have downloaded the show and those that have donated to the Sync Book. I really appreciate it. I do not make a single cent off the show, and all the money goes towards the Sync Book website to keep this thing up and running. The show takes a lot of time, and I do this out of the love of sharing such fantastic info with everyone, so thank you for your support. Please make sure to pass this podcast on any way you can, via social media, word of mouth, passenger pigeon, smoke signal, any way that you can. I would really appreciate it. I just booked a bunch of great musical guests for the show, such as the Americana folk band The Harmed Brothers, the metal band Issa from Eugene, Oregon, the country singer-songwriter D.L. Marble from Durango, Colorado, and the roots reggae band Natty Nation. So there's just a great mix of eclectic music for your listening pleasure coming up. I'm looking at possibly putting together a compilation CD of all the music on this show for sale, with all the proceeds going to a local charity, but this is still in the works and is just in its infancy, so hopefully that will come to fruition in the future. If you know of any bands that would like to be highlighted on the show, please shoot me an email at martyleeds33@gmail.com, or you can just catch me on Facebook, and that's at Marty Leeds. Tonight's guests are author, researcher, and inventor Crichton E. Miller, and the musical guest is Fred Cusinato. This show is brought to you by the Sync Book Radio. Check out all the wonderful podcasts, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Middle Chamber, and Synchronize. More information about Sync Book Press, Sync Book Radio, or Sync Book events can be found at www.thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends and please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website, and consider setting up a monthly charge as it helps us keep the lights on and helps keep our microphones humming. And as always, thank you for your support. Our guest tonight is Crichton E. Miller. Crichton Miller is a self-motivated, free-thinking, and highly accomplished entrepreneur, and is also an amateur historian, navigator, inventor, and religious researcher. In 1997, after years of intense thought, research, and practical experiments, Crichton made a historical discovery of an artifact that is prevalent throughout the ancient world, and one that has lasted till modern times. Crichton, through his understanding of astronomy, navigation, geometry, myth, and history, synthesized his knowledge into constructing the Celtic Cross, a navigational tool that can be used for timekeeping, highly accurate geometrical measurements, and one that unifies and integrates the cycles of time as above and so below. Awarded a patent for his discovery and demonstrated at Cambridge University in October 2006, essentially what Crichton has achieved is to rediscover an ancient and prehistoric instrument that once had translated nature's mathematics into a usable format for our ancestors on a worldwide basis in prehistory. His book, The Golden Thread of Time, thoroughly explains in detail his discovery using poetry, astrology, astronomy, geometry, and historical precedents. His work is also featured in the DVD The Cross of Thoth, released through Reality Entertainment in 2007. His website is www.crichtonmiller.com, and Crichton is spelled C-R-I-C-H-T-O-N. So without further ado, let's get pious with Crichton E. Miller. Crichton, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for taking the time to join me.
Thanks, Marty. It's great to be with you, and hi to all your listeners.
Great, great. You know, I've been looking forward to the show for quite some time because I'm just a huge fan of your work. I discovered you about a few years ago, I think, through the Cross of Thoth DVD, and yeah, then had your book, The Golden Thread of Time, on my wish list for quite some time. And I finally picked it up about last week, and I'm finishing up right now. And I think you've done something really spectacular with this book. I feel like this is a seminal work on occult wisdom, and I feel the Celtic Cross is honestly one of the major discoveries of the probably the last 500 years, if not more. So I really want to walk through step by step for the listeners your discovery and how you came to uncover and unveil this ancient navigational tool that has really been this sort of secret in plain sight for years. Because as I know, as you've said, you've been seeing Celtic crosses your entire life. Can you give us some background into what brought you into this discovery and how you came to find this?
Yeah, it's there's lots of I ask often ask the question, how can I see it and nobody else can? And so you can go into things like how I was brought up, my schooling, my experiences in life. But particularly the most important thing is from a very small child, I've always been curious, always looking, always asking the questions. I never was one, although not being antisocial, I was never one for accepting what other human beings tell me. I need to check it out for myself. And in my life, I've done a great deal of things, and some of them is building, construction, but most importantly, navigation. So I guess the life experiences as well allowed me to look at using reason and common sense, which is my byword, use reason and common sense, is to say, well, how could these people achieve these things, such as the building of the pyramids? What was Stonehenge really for? And there's a great issue. I'm going to go off on one a little bit here, but there's a great problem with people living in a world where they don't really have to think about survival, and that their minds can run away with any old wild idea that they want. And that is that nobody in our ancestors' times, if you like, did anything that didn't mean anything, if you get what I mean. So if they created a symbol or a story, it had a real meaning behind it.
Everything was imbued with meaning.
Everything was imbued with meaning. And what happens is every day people walk past a cross on a church, or they see a cross in a graveyard, and they don't think about it. Now, particularly the Celtic cross, which is one with a wheel around it. Now, what on earth has that got to do with the crucifixion? So you would think you would say to yourself, hang on a minute, why has it got a wheel around it? Would I mean, it makes common sense to say, why would they do that? Unless you have a thing called, which is quite scientifically interesting at the moment from a psychological point of view, unless you suffer from a thing called precognitive bias, which means that you've already prejudged the situation before you can see it and before you can smell it or you taste it or hear it. So somebody comes to you and says something and you go, no, that can be right, because you've already prejudged it. Yeah, that's really important. Human beings tend to have suffer from precognitive bias. Now,
That's
the other
rampant in our day and age, right?
absolutely, absolutely rampant. So I do things like, hey, take the best college dictionaries and look up the original meaning of words. And when you do that and you look at the etymology of the words, the base root of the word, then what you find is it has a meaning that's entirely different to that which you're using in contemporary language. So therefore, if you want to understand what our ancestors, our parents, 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 parents were trying to send as a message or pass on to their offspring, and you don't speak the same language, or you don't understand the meaning of the words, how can you possibly read what they're saying?
Yeah, etymology is an instrumental, right?
Absolutely instrumental. So, for instance, here's a shocker for you. Look up the meaning of the word meek. When we look in religion, the meek, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Very few people, they don't think it means gentle, but actually it doesn't. It comes from Old English. Terrible word, mean it's muke, from mucus, muck, slime, and dirt, and it means spiritless. And that puts a completely different meaning on that teaching, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So then you start to say, okay, well, what are they trying to say? That the meek shall inherit the earth. That means they're going to get rid of all the kings, the queens, the churches, everybody that stands up there that's supposed to be of service to mankind. And what they're going to put is the meek in charge. Yeah?
Which is what we have right now, right?
Which is what we have right now. So there you have a prophecy that's right. Yeah, only when you understand the meaning of the word. So here's another one for you. Temple. Oh, my body is a temple, say people. Okay. Well, temple comes from tiempo, meaning time in Latin. So when you look at a temple, it means a place of keeping time.
Yeah, and Tam, I believe, is an ancient Egyptian. The suffix Tam is an ancient Egyptian word too, correct?
Absolutely. And one of the things about the Egyptian language, you've got to be ever so careful with the Egyptian language because they, as you know, they don't use vowels. Yeah, it's consonant-based language and very much it's a symbolic language. So they would make symbols that meant many things. But I guess the best example of that would be the letter S, which looks like a snake, sounds like a snake.
It's slippery, it's slithery, it's snaky, it's serpent, right?
Yeah, it's a serpent.
Yeah.
And there you are. You use S every day, but you don't think about it. A symbol means what? Yeah, sure, but it actually means a snake. And
And it even looks like it, right?
sure, and it looks like a snake, and that's the whole point. Now, that's really important in terms of understanding a lot of the ancient people, what they were trying to say about the serpents being important. But basically, I can give you one indication now, which is quite important. And have you ever seen the symbol St. George and the dragon?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really famous symbol. And that's where St. George is slaying the dragon. Well, what does that mean? Well, actually, what it means is for thousands of years, we used astrology to keep time. So, what does that mean? Well, in Genesis 1, verse 14, it says quite straightforwardly, God made the sun and the moon and the stars to be signs in the sky. And signs an astrological term. And that was to keep time for the day, the minute, the hour, the week, the month, and the year. So it tells you strictly in Genesis, right? You are supposed to keep time using the signs in the sky. Well, the most powerful sign of all was the dragon, the serpent. It's wrapped around the North Pole. That's the one that rotates around. And if you look at a watch on your wrist, if you still have an old-fashioned type of watch that has a hand or a clock, then that hand rotates roughly at the same speed as the Earth spins. Not quite, because they've converted it to a 12-hour clock, but in the old days, and we had a lot of problems with time today, didn't we, Marty? Whereabouts are you on the Earth and what time is it? And what they did is they invented 24-hour clocks. So let's go back to the idea of temple. So temples were places of keeping time, and the priests that were in it kept time, and they used astrology to keep time. Now, people don't like the word of astrology. Scientists particularly, they would prefer to call it a pseudoscience. But actually, astrology means basic astronomy. That's what the word means.
This is something that it always gets to me too, because when we were talking about etymology and understanding the words, when you look at astrology, ology just means the study of, and astro means stars. So the
That's correct.
study of stars. So what's wrong
Well,
with
it's
that?
a little bit further than that. It means astrologic. So that means logic, which is mathematics. So it's mathematics of the stars. So that's a scientific term when you understand it, isn't it?
Yeah,
So
absolutely.
no, so they put all these signs in around the Earth because as the Earth spun at night, you could see these signs go by. And because of the motion of the Earth around the Sun, then these signs changed every night. So the one that you would see at midnight would be different, slightly different than the one you saw the night before. And after so many days, it would be a different sign that you would see south at midnight. And what they figured out, and this is what people can't understand, we talk about flat Earth. Now, we know that the ancient Egyptians and the Mesopotamians worked on a person's birth sign, their sun sign. But if you look at the sky and the sun's in it, you can't see what sign's behind it. Can you?
No.
So how did they know?
They would have to
Well,
know it's round.
absolutely. And they would have to know that the sun was in the sign that was opposite the one they saw at midnight in darkness the night before. So they made a circle of 12 signs. And wherever the sun was in was the opposite of the one that was at midnight the day before. But they had another constellation, and this is what's missing. The other constellation that told time was that which span round the celestial pole. So you have got two signs. You go around the belt of the middle of the Earth, which we call the zodiac after animals, zoo for animals, and belt. So it was the belt of animals. But there's one in the northern hemisphere, which the Egyptians call the imperishable stars. They never die, which means they don't set below the horizon. And that circle is controlled by the dragon, the serpent, the worm.
Oh, which is the Latin Draco, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Draco, Draconis.
And so
Now,
these are in the northern hemisphere, these are the, yeah, they never set. You can always, they're always visible.
that's right. Well, except in daylight,
Except in
obviously.
daylight, yeah, obviously.
So at night, what happens is the head of the dragon travels round at the same speed in the opposite direction to the hour hand. So once you know that that's the case, you say, okay, now I can measure time. Fine, I can measure time at the same rate as my little watch hand can or a clock on a church. But of course, you can't unless you can measure it. Now, that requires an instrument to measure it. So there's only one instrument that can measure it, and that is a model of it. So what happened is they made a model of it. Long, long time ago, they made a model of it. And you can see it all over the world, even the Amerindians, they had their medicine wheels. And that's a model of what I'm talking about. And that's what, bless them, they taught the children before, I'm probably talking on touchy ground here for you guys in America, but that's what was taken away from them. The ability to sit down with their children and say, look, the world spins and the stars spin like this, and the seasons happen like this, and everything grows because of the seasons and because of the sun, and it dies because of the season and the sun. So let's take you back to King George and the dragon, because there was no difference in Britain and no difference in Europe, no difference with any. Now, the Chinese, they have their own system of saying this. But what the British said was, St. George, of which our flag is named after, St. George slew the dragon. Well, in what he did is he slew time.
Yeah.
He slew the dragon's ability to measure time. And that happened in the 14th century when we invented the first 24-hour clock. Didn't need the dragon anymore. In the churches to keep time.
Yeah. Yeah, and the symbol of the slaying the dragon is, I mean, not only is this is something that's actually just plastered all over alchemy as well. You see this all over. So it's this, yeah. And it's almost this idea of at least how I understand it, it's almost like man getting off the wheel of time, getting off the wheel of fortune, wheel of fate, and slaying that dragon so it can get out of time, if you will. Does that make
Oh.
sense?
Well, you might say that from, and that would apply to what the Hindus say, because the Hindus believe in reincarnation. And one of the things they're always saying is, oh Lord, let me off this wheel of life. But that's not what it means. What it means is we don't need astrology anymore.
Oh, okay. I get what you're saying. Okay.
Now, there are a lot of alchemical things that have gone on, but actually, when you bore down to it, you have to understand one thing. Now, apart from being an writing books and finding out about old, what old people got up to and what our ancestors got up to, I run timekeeping systems. I've designed a million line of code in .NET to control temporary worker supply chains for Walmart and all the big names, right? And that's about, it's completely scalable. It's about managing time, and it's about transparency, and it's about all of that. Well, you see, if you can manage time and then you can manage people, you've got control, haven't you?
Yeah, absolute control.
Okay, got absolute control. That's exactly what Constantine did when he put the Roman Empire in the Holy Roman Church. What he did is he said, I will conquer the world with a cross.
Wow.
Okay? Now, that's exactly what he did. He conquered the world with a cross because the cross can measure the dragon and it can measure the angles and it can also find latitude and longitude so you can conquer the whole world. And because of that, Christendom expanded across the whole world. Now, you might say, okay, what's that got to do with business? Well, it's simple. It has to do with a thing called talent. Do you know what talent means?
No, what does that mean?
Oh, it's an old Greek thing meaning money. So when people call themselves talented, what they don't understand what they're saying is that actually that means that the governments or businesses can count their value over the period of years that they live. And what's their contribution into the coffer, yeah? Mm-hmm. That's what talent means. It's a gift, right? If you're gifted, that's not talent, but it could be turned into talent. So what happened is the old kings and queens, way, way back, they would get this little center, okay? And out of that little center, they would say, right, around me, how much agriculture have I got? And how many people work in it? And in that agriculture, how much revenue can we get from that? Yeah? Mm-hmm. Nothing's different today. It's exactly the same.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say, it's the same thing we have today.
Exactly the same. Never changed. Okay, never changed from the original story in the Bible of Cain and Abel, where Cain made a sacrifice to God based on wheat, okay, and Abel made a sacrifice based on lambs and sheep. Mm-hmm. So apparently God was pleased with Abel, but he wasn't too pleased with Cain. And why would that be? Well, it has relevance today. It's very simple that if you have to revert to an agricultural society, then you have to protect that area of agriculture that which you control. Mm-hmm. Whereas Abel, he was like the old hunter-gatherers. What happened with him was he could wander endlessly across unfenced lands to feed his sheep. Mm-hmm. Now, if you were God, right, let's presume whatever God is, without offending any of your people, if you were God, right, would you be happy with a system that you could tell in the future was going to cause wars like the ones we're seeing over resources? Or would you be happy with people didn't own the earth, but they went about picking what was ever there due to the season?
And they lived symbiotically with it, right?
Correct. And that's where we came apart. And that's what that story is all about. That's what it's all about.
The divorcing of from nature, basically, right? Divorcing from the cycles of time, divorcing sure. from, right?
Sure. Now let's go back to nature, because you see, we're always at war with nature. What does that really mean? Well, the word nature comes from NTR, netter.
Netter, yeah.
Yeah, and from the Egyptian nature spirits, meaning netteru. So every living creature, like the American Red Indians used to say, the bison, the bear, they all have their great spirit. Each one has a great spirit under the great spirit. And so each one was a god of its own type. Mm-hmm. Okay? So when they killed a deer or a bison, they would say thank you for the sustenance offered as a sacrifice by the spirit of bison by letting one of its own go. Yeah, total respect.
Yeah.
That's powerful stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I've always understood it too as like as each animal is symbolic of and attributes of this great creator being. If you know what I'm saying, that each animal or each, you know, a rock, an animal, a hillside, a rolling, any of that stuff is basically embodying the principles of this great creator being. And that's why it was revered by these ancient cultures.
Absolutely. And that's the point. So it was to live in balance. So let's go back to the word netteru, from which netteru and netter is the Egyptian word for God, the big God. Mm-hmm. Now, out of that came the word nature. So when we say that we're at war with nature, what are we saying?
We're at war with God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what we're saying.
Yeah. I think Manly P. Hall even talks about the fact that the ancient cultures, whether this was the Manu or Buddha or any of these guys, they understood that when they were, you know, that the laws of nature were expressions, outflowing expressions of the laws of God. So therefore, by following natural law was therefore to follow the laws of God.
Absolutely. Right. Now, the laws of God are about time. And that's what's so powerful about what our ancestors did when they built the great pyramids, which is a clock. And you can measure time with it in place. And when they built the great stone circles, not just in Europe, but also the types of measurements you've got, like the Great Serpent Mounds in Ohio.
I was just going to say, I mean, you're hitting such an important point right here, because especially with archaeoastronomical research that we have going on today, What you're saying is irrefutable. We can go to the Mayan pyramids. We can go to the Great Pyramid of Giza. We can go to the Serpent Mound. We can go all of these places and absolutely see, without a question, that these are aligned to the stars, that these are timekeeping mechanisms.
That's right. That's exactly what they are. Now, timekeeping, we would say, okay, so then let's bring in the cross as a principle. Now, in China, they use the Luopan. The principle is exactly the same.
What is that? Can you explain that?
Luopan, L-U-O-P-A-N, is the Chinese instrument for feng shui. Right? And it's exactly the same. If you hang a plumb line from the middle of it, you can observe the stars and you can do astrology. Mm-hmm. If you can do astrology, you can keep time. Mm-hmm. Because it's astrologic, so it's about the progression of the stars. And what's important about this, it's our mathematics, because there is no way we could have sent men to the moon or go to Mars or do anything if we hadn't got this inherited mathematics that was developed from our own planet spinning and orbiting. Mm-hmm. That's where our maths comes from. And if you look at the Great Pyramids, built in. So in the Great Pyramid, you've got one of the pyramids there. Okay, it's got... most people think it's got four faces, but the Great Pyramid of Khufu is actually the eight faces.
Eight faces, absolutely.
And if you take the internal, measurements from geometry, because this is all about geometry, and count each 180-faced internal triangle up, you come to 720. Mm-hmm. Now the thing is, it's the moon. This is where the thing about Thoth comes from. It's the moon's speed over the Earth is 720 miles an hour.
Oh, really? I did not know that. Okay.
Oh, and the sun and the stars travel at 900 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm using a little bit of play on this because there are two kinds of miles. There's statute miles, okay, and there's nautical miles.
Nautical miles, yeah.
And one nautical mile is equal to one arc minute.
Yeah.
So you got 360 degrees times 60, and those are your arc minutes. And again, by 60 is your arc seconds.
And this gives you 21,600, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. And now you have 2,160 years in every period or epoch, if you like. So the age of Aries, the age of Pisces, the age of Taurus, and the so-called upcoming age of Aquarius. Mm-hmm. They're each 2,160 years long, and 12 of those makes 25,920 years. Why is that important? Because that is the rotation, the wobble of the Earth caused by lunar solar precession. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't for that wobble, we wouldn't have life as we know it. Mm-hmm. Because it's that wobble that causes the seasons.
Yeah. And this precession, the equinoxes, is as far as we can tell, this has been mapped for quite a long time. This is basically from the beginning of recorded history, right?
Absolutely. But the thing is, you cannot navigate without knowing it.
Absolutely, yeah.
And if you look, for instance, at the Polynesian Matang, which is an exact almost replica of what people call the Maltese Cross, and then imagine that's the planet Earth, okay, looking at it from the side, then it shows you the rising point of the sun at the summer solstice and the rising point of the sun at the winter solstice. And then Matang has got a little triangle in the middle, okay, so it shows you the equinox, both in the east and the west. But it mimics that degrees of angle by the wobble of the Earth. So it shows the same cross at the north and south poles. So people just see a cross, but they don't see what I see because they don't navigate. So they haven't got a clue. But then they don't have a clue how the stars go around the Earth. They don't have a clue how the sun rises and feeds them.
Yeah, you know, you talk in the book about this not just being a cross for navigation. This also brings in the astronomy, the astrology, the geometry, the mathematics, you know, all of these things is what this cross is embedding, all of these things. And as you're saying, most people just walk by, and how many people just relate that to, you know, Jesus on the cross or whatever, having absolutely no idea what this simple symbol is actually unveiling to humanity.
Sure. Well, if you want to talk about Jesus, then what you've got to ask yourself a question. It was the elder of elders of the Maya that told me. When I went to see him back in 1997, I gave him a cross designed in the way that the Maya used it, which is a bundle. Now, that old anybody that understands about the Maya people will understand that they use things and they call them bundles. They knock it down into a bundle. So I made him a bundle, and it assembled into a cross. And he said, "Thank you very much. That is our lost staff of power with which we built the pyramids. But that which your Jesus Christ was sacrificed on for his knowledge of spirituality and wisdom and science," sorry, his exact thing was, he was murdered on the cross for his spiritual and scientific knowledge.
And giving this information away to humanity is what the myth is portraying, right?
Yeah. And you've got to imagine this guy, you know, Jesus was in the line of the bloodline of David, and they came out of Egypt. So you now can get into Akhenaten and the ideas of Amun and Amen. So he was the last shepherd, supposedly. Okay, so he came in like that, and he went into the temple, and he saw in the house of God, a place that's supposed to be non-materialistic, money changers. Mm-hmm. And he saw people sacrificing and charging money for it. So they call him meek, you know, in the sense of being gentle. But what he did is he went back out and he made himself a whip of cords. And he went into that temple and he threw over the tables and he beat the crap out of them. Now, he's not got much chance, is he? Because if you did that on Wall Street now, what would happen?
Yeah, right.
but that's Wall Street is what it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wall Street is designed to do that. So that's okay. That's the name of the game. But hey, you're going to save people's souls and look after them in a temple, a place of measuring time, which is dedicated to God, right? That's going to make a holy man really pissed, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. So anyway, they engineered to nail him on it, didn't they?
Yeah.
And in doing so, hid it for another 2,000 years.
Yeah, and very well, huh?
And very well. And why wouldn't they? Let's face it. You see, I patented the cross. So God will bless them. All the churches in the world, they can have symbols of the cross anywhere, right? But if the moment they make that wheel spin, they've got to come to me.
Yeah, if you don't mind, speaking of this secret knowledge, I just want to read something from your book here. It says, "It is in my opinion that this knowledge may have been kept secret for the following reason. The Trade Guild or Society members were sworn to secrecy during or after their apprenticeship so as to protect their knowledge from the uninitiated. Later, this position of power and prestige was reversed, and the religious authorities, from the destruction of the Library of Alexandria through to the 17th century AD, were to persecute those who practiced anything of the ancient arts and crafts. The actions of the Spanish Inquisition in Europe and the destruction of the Aztec, Maya, and Inca civilizations by the conquistadors can ably demonstrate this. There is good reason to think that the Celtic cross was ancient before the builders of the pyramids used it, and it originated from a knowledge that was pre-flood." Very, very powerful words.
Thank you very much. Probably better than the way I was trying to explain it. You get a little bit of time when you write things down.
Exactly, but right.
It's very hard to stay neutral in this. But I do know this, Sir Isaac Newton knew it, in my opinion, because when they were trying to find out how to find a longitude, and Harrison invented his chronometer, because the British Navy were clumsily running their ships up the rocks and things, mm-hmm. Okay. Then he said that longitude would be found through astronomy. Well, that's right. You can find longitude without a clock easily if you know how the speed of the moon, and you've got an almanac. I think the proper is an ephemeris, is the one which gives you the dates and positions and times of the moon, the stars, and so forth, okay, at midnight. And that's really important, isn't it? After what we were just talking about with the serpent, because you can tell the position of everything at midnight with the serpent, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, if you've got this kind of knowledge, wouldn't you have a snake sticking out in the middle of your forehead and your beard made to look like a snake's tail?
Yeah.
Okay, so they did what they did. But make no mistake about the Egyptians and the Chinese. They managed to keep civilizations going for 4,000 and 5,000 years in the face of order and chaos. They managed to keep the people together for immense amounts of time. Are we lucky if we can keep a civilization together more than 300 years?
I'm just wondering when this one is going to fall.
Well, it will fall if it doesn't get together.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's true of everything, because every civilization has died because the people became corrupt. They started fighting amongst each other. They split each other up, and then along came the barbarian and took over.
Do you feel like now is the time that we really need to, especially with how much chaos that is ensuing right now across the world, do you really feel like now is the time that to open that occult book of wisdom and let all eyes look upon it? Do you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, that's what it's been kept for.
Yeah.
That's what it's kept for. The problem is that people have become so confused. Let me give you an example. You talk about the guys into UFOs, yeah? No, yeah. I'm against that. Because I looked in the sky for most of my life and mistook a lot of satellites for UFOs before I figured out what they were. Okay? And that's what it can do to you. Okay? The UFO phenomenon. But in actual fact, you turn around and insult your ancestors when you say that your father's 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 father didn't build the pyramids, because he did. Mm-hmm. That throws something else into question. How about this idea of Darwinism's evolution? Mm-hmm. Are we really improving? Now, I'll give you a question. People say to me, hey, we're better. We've got great technology. I said, did you invent it, or are you just a user?
Yeah. There's a comedian that says, if I stuck you out in the woods, how long would it take for you to make me an iPhone? We don't know anything about this stuff.
We know nothing about it. So let's go back to what you're saying. These guys, they built it into churches. And I'll tell you a lot of the people who did it, and go back to the story of Christ. Christ was a carpenter. His father was a carpenter. Mm-hmm. Now, builders and carpenters in those days, it wasn't like what you think now, that you can run around making flat-pack fitted kitchens up. Mm-hmm. These guys carved esoteric and very important spiritual messages into temples. That's what they did.
Books written to stone.
Books written in stone. Now, I would say when our Lord Jesus Christ was killed on the symbol of his own science and spirituality, that those guys were underground, wouldn't you?
Yeah, they were the subversive movement against the powers that be, right?
Yeah, and they were so underground, they were able to carve their messages in the churches right under the noses of the people that would have persecuted them. Mm-hmm. That's why you've got a cross on the grave.
And then you look at talking about these these buildings being aligned to the stars and things like that. When you look at who are we talking about here? If you're talking about Jesus mythologically being a shepherd, well, what were they doing? They were looking at the stars. You look at the navigators. What were they doing in order to navigate the oceans? They were looking at the stars.
Yeah, I do it. I'm a qualified navigator, and I go out. I single handle an ocean going yacht. I've done it for many years, and when it's at night, I can tell where I'm.
Yeah.
And still, I think there's 5 navigators left in Polynesia that can do that. Mm-hmm.
So the applicability of this stuff is unquestionable, right?
Absolutely, but there's no difference. A GPS, the global position navigation system, is simply the same principle. We bung a false star into the sky called a satellite. We bounce a signal from it to our recorder. That measures the angle between that and the center of the Earth. Tells you where you are on the Earth's surface. There's no difference between that and the cross and measuring an angle of a star and doing the same triangulation. It's just the same.
Mm-hmm. Hey, can
except,
we...
Except you can use the GPS when it's raining, when it's pretty hard to do that with a cross if the clouds are covered, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. can we step back here a little bit? And I kind of want to talk about a little bit about how the cross is constructed and maybe the mechanics of it.
Okay. Sure. Well, there's 2 kinds of cross, basic crosses. One is the Celtic cross or Woden's wheel, which can be found in engravings and so forth in Scandinavia in 1400 BC on ships. So that cross is very simple. It has to do with mechanics. You can't get a huge accuracy with it, but it doesn't matter. And I've written about that in my book. It's built with a wheel with a weight on it because it damps at sea. When you're at sea, you've got a 60-foot skin boat. You're bobbing up and down on the waves. And therefore, if you were to use a cross with a plumb line on it, that plumb line would just vibrate too much, and you wouldn't get any accuracy. But with a wheel, it tends to dampen. So as the wheel rocks, as the boat goes up and down, it still points very much at the center of the Earth, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
The other one is the most important one. This is the one that I discovered in the Great Pyramid of Giza called the Dixon Relics. I didn't dig it out. A guy called Wayman Dixon did back in 1872. And particular instrument, parts of it are in the British Museum, but it was sent in a cigar box to the astronomer royal of Scotland at the time called Piazzi Smythe. And there it remained, and I think the bit of wood is away. But what Piazzi Smythe said was quite straightforward. He says, well, that's a plumb bob, and there's a measuring stick. And if you look at the little symbol on the top, which is in my book, it's an Aryan symbol. It means Aries. It's the sign of the horn, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
The twin horns, which is the symbol for Aries.
Sure.
Which we still use in astronomy today, and we also use in navigation today.
Do you feel that symbol that's on that was found, do you think that it represents the time period that this was created as well?
There's no doubt about that. Despite what everybody else says and everything that they argue about, that part of the pyramid, it's very difficult to say that's when he originally constructed it, yeah? Because
sure.
It was constructed on stone circles and megaliths and all sorts. So it had been a very unique site for observing the stars for perhaps a long time before the pyramids were built.
And by the time, just to back up here a second, and by that time you mean basically we're talking about, once again, 2,160 years per age. So we're talking between 2,160 to 4,320 years ago, right?
Absolutely. Okay. Now, there's something else that's very important here. You see, we have a pole star now called Polaris,
yeah,
which is in the tail of the little dog. And it's on, between it and the Great Bear is the dragon I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back to 2800 BC, then Alpha Draconis in the tail of the dragon was the pole star.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
which is Thuban, right?
Yeah, some people call it Thuban. That's right. It's Alpha Draconis.
It's
a tail, okay? Now, I don't know, for anybody listening that understands a bit of navigation, if you take the Great Bear or the Great Dipper, which is best to use it as, you use the outer two stars of the Dipper. You follow, they're called the pointer stars. They point directly to Polaris, which is our current pole star and has been since the 15th century. Prior to that, there's been no pole star since 2160 BC, roughly,
mm-hmm.
between 2800 and 2160. Now, if you go back to the Big Dipper and you turn the inner two stars, which is almost a mirror of the outer two stars, pointer star, you use them as pointer stars, the first star you come to is Alpha Draconis, or Thuban.
Okay.
Now, between that time of when the pyramids were built and the time that we had our enlightenment, which wonders if it's connected, in the 14th and 15th centuries, there was no pole star. And it took a tremendous amount of mathematics to find it. Now, if you wanted to find it, you had to use a pentagram.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Surely. Well, get back to this number I told you about on the pyramids of 720 and 72, and this is where it gets a little bit freaky for some people. You see, the wobble of the Earth, precession of the equinoxes, which is what we're talking about here because it's all linked, is 1 degree every 72 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you want to use a pentagram, then if you divide 360 degrees by 5, you got 72.
Okay.
Okay? Yeah. So 72 is a really important number. So if you look around Draconis, you'll see where the north pole of the sun is, which never varies. It's always constant within about 1 or 1.5 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Then if you slap a pentagram over that, it's slap in the middle. The north pole of the sun is slap in the middle of that pentagram.
Okay.
Now you say, well, what does that mean? Okay, well, it means you can find true north for navigation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. This is long before they invented magnetic compasses. And even if you've got magnetic compass, it isn't true because you've got variations in magnets, in the magnetism, depending where you are on the Earth.
Sure.
You can't find. You need to either take off or add some figures depending on your line of longitude because of the variation in the magnetics in that. So you're trying to find true north. Well, what I'm saying to you is from 2000 years BC to nearly 1400 years AD, okay, a 3,500 period, there was no pole star. How do you navigate?
Yeah, that's
Now, how you navigate is you have very clever mathematicians, and it's a secret.
with using what the other thing that's really interesting about this is it's using simple geometry. I mean, even the pentagram was known as the secret emblem of the Pythagoreans, right?
Sure,
So,
simple geometry. But all our mathematics come from geometry.
yeah.
Now, one of the things they say now, and it was Islam that invented algebra in Timbuktu, 800 AD. And that was one of the, and that was because they managed to inherit some of the stuff that was lost as Europe went into the Dark Ages.
Sure, yeah.
But in actual fact, when you look at that, if it wasn't for Islam, we wouldn't have in England, we'd have Cambridge and Oxford universities, because the knowledge that came out of North Spain from the Islamic people allowed us to get back out of the Dark Ages.
Yeah.
There's a lot of fixing to be done here, isn't there?
The thing that always gets me is the utter simplicity of this stuff. We were just talking about the pentagram. This encodes the divine proportion. As you said, you use it, put it on the sun to find the North Pole, all of this stuff. And when we look at the Celtic cross, the thing that gets me so much about this is, or not the Celtic cross, but just the cross in itself, and using the plumb line and the bob, this is ridiculously simple. I mean, what did you do? You put two sticks together, used a plumb line and a bob, and had a whole bunch of ingenuity. And this allows you to do geometry or earth measure.
Yeah, and I don't let me get too arrogant and cocky about this. I didn't invent it. I was just like born in 1949 and somebody gave it to me or something. But it's not mine, it's yours. It's everybody that's listening, it belongs to you, it's your ancestors.
I'm so glad you're saying this, man, because this is something that I really harp on with this stuff. It's that, we're not, you're not the discoverer of this, you're the rediscoverer of this,
That's it.
and
That's it.
if you don't.
Shoot me down if I get above myself and I get arrogant, because I'm not. And I'm 65 this year. I'll tell you what, if I'm not drooling down a Zimmer frame in 15 years' time, I'm out of here. So what's the point? I found something and I want to give it back to the people.
I just want to say something here too. This is something that you mentioned in the book about what you're saying right now. It says, Tom, there's this a great esotericist, Thomas Burgoyne, that said, "To each according to his talent shall the mysteries of the kingdom be revealed. To everyone according to his humility, spiritual light, and merit. But from the arrogant, the selfish, the spiritually proud shall all things be taken away, and truth shroud herself in a veil of delusion." One of the contributors in your books, I think his name is James Bowles, said that there is a purity in the ancient wisdom that hides itself from the self-indulgent. In a sense, it's the ancients' way of choosing who will carry on the tradition. And he says, and it appears you, Crichton, have been selected. And I feel that true wisdom comes from the divine. It comes from that intelligent source at work within the cosmos and nature, the grand architect, if you will. And I think that the acquisition of such knowledge comes from having that integrity, having that good heart, having an open mind, holistic approach. And it is not just some simple, intellectual pursuit. I mean, obviously you resonate with that idea, right?
Yeah, very much so. It's a gift. I write
It
that
is
in
a
the book.
gift.
Gift. It is a
And
gift.
speaking of time, a gift is a present. And of course, the present is the eternal now. So right back, we're right, once again, we look at that language and we are talking about time.
That's it. And you talk about time, and the big problem we have in the world today is that most people, they see things in a linear form. That is, I started out on the road at birth, and I came to where I am now, and I'm going somewhere else. That's not how our ancestors saw time. There was no past, and there is no future. There is only potential for future, but everything that ever happened's been done and gone. But you can't put your hand back and change a single thing. Write it all the time, don't they? You hear it. The hand, moving hand has writ and moves on, and you can't change it. So what's the point about complaining and trying to get revenge on something your mother's mother did to you when you were a kid? You know, like, pack it in, get on with your life before you're hanging over a Zimmer frame.
Your book is called The Golden Thread of Time. Do you want to talk about what the symbolism of the golden thread is?
Yeah, the golden thread of time really is, I wrote a poem at the beginning of the book, and really it was about, you know, how our ancestors view time. And of course, even in the Bible, if you read it properly, they believed that you couldn't die. You know, it was only the living that tasted death. Because, you know, when you die, you don't know you've died. So it's only the people left behind to watch it that go, oh my goodness, look at that. Isn't it?
Yeah.
That's but what they also believe that if you stand every morning and you, on a spring morning or a midsummer, you see the same looking butterflies and the same, and you look at a field of wheat that's standing there getting green and growing, you know, but there was one last year and one the year before. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. So they felt that of human beings too. And this is why it was such a powerful thing in its early days, because the promise was that you couldn't die.
That's it's always been sort of the quest for immortality, right?
Yeah, but that's the whole point. This is a story of we've just talked in the talking about time of the discovery or understanding of the fruit of the tree of knowledge and good and evil. And I'll expand on that if you want me to.
Sure.
But what is the serpent? Well, I just told you about what the serpent is. The serpent is that sign in the sky that gave us power over order and chaos. Mm-hmm. And the ability to predict. So if you're going to put seeds in the ground, you better put them in the ground at the right time of year. If you don't know what the right time of the year is, you're not going to get a crop. If you don't get a crop, you're going to starve and die.
And the serpent actually kind of represents both chaos and order in and itself. Well, I mean, you even have the two serpents that you see in like Egyptian iconography, right? Where you have, you know, the one on the left, one on the right. And then you even look at the attributes or the symbols of a serpent. You have the venom, but then you also have the anti-venom, which is the cure to the venom.
That's correct. So, I mean, I see the cross as that. You stick the cross in people's faces, you know, you say, look at that. You don't think anything until you saw the wheel spin. And when you see the wheel spin, hang on, does that cure anything?
No.
Does it cure anything?
No.
Well, that depends on the person looking, doesn't it?
Ah, yeah, perspective, huh? Yeah.
Does it cure the lies? Does it cure the spin, as we call it in politics in Britain? I don't know if you do in America, but we call lying spin.
Yeah, same thing here, yeah.
Well, the cross spins beautifully. How's that for curing a lie?
You know, you say in the book, academic institutions are extremely reluctant to acknowledge supposition and speculation as proof of existence. Rightly so, careers can be ruined and misinformation spread if supposition was relied upon too heavily. I am fortunate in this respect in that I am an independent researcher and not bound by their rules. The Celtic cross is something that's been patented. It's been used by other people, right? This has been confirmed that this thing works. Have you received any sort of like backlash or dismissal of this discovery from any sort of like modern scholars at all?
Never. Since 1997, not once. And you can understand why. I mean, the whole scientific principle is this: you have a theory, you test it, you make a model. When you make the model and that works, okay, now why should it not have been a proven theory under the laws of science?
Absolutely.
And that's what it does. It works. It does everything that answers all the mysteries of the ancients. Why the pyramids were built, what it is, could they travel the world, how did they keep time, everything you can think of, it does. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it would be a very brave scientist stand up and challenge that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
I've asked for it. I've asked for it since 1997. I've asked to be challenged. And what happens when you make a really mind-shattering discovery, which is what it is, it overturns a lot of preconceived historical views. And in overturning that, the best thing to do with it is say nothing.
Yeah. This is, you know, you're making such a great point right now, because I was actually just at a wedding the other weekend, and, you know, I was talking about this podcast, and I was like, hey, I'm getting this guy on, he's discovered this Celtic cross thing, and I was explaining the whole thing, and the blank look on people's faces, it's really interesting that how many people are not aware of this, and yet to me, like, as, you know, as I started this podcast saying that I think this is one of the major discoveries of the last 500 years, and that to me is just, it's kind of insane.
Well, I feel like that. I mean, I'm used to it now, but I wasn't used to it when I first discovered it. It's a little bit getting used to. I thought, what is this? I was working out, the position of the pyramids from the idea of a surveyor, from a surveyor's point of view. I was saying, well, what could they have used? We don't need any of this UFO stuff and aliens from outer space and things like that. What we need to do is find out how our clever old ancestors could actually achieve this. Well, one of the most important things in the Egyptian area of truth is a plumb bob. If you're going to go to hell or you're going to go to heaven on the way into the heart ceremony, guess what they use? A plumb bob.
Plumb bob,
So they pretty much believe that that's pretty foolproof. Okay. Now, I don't know if you know this, quite interesting. In my opinion, there are only two constants in the universe that you can rely on, or in our planet that you can rely on. And that is a plumb bob. It always points to the center of the Earth, no variation. And the other one is the North Pole of the Sun itself. Those are the only two things that are constant. And they soon figured that out and measured it with a plumb bob. Okay? Everything else after that is nonsense, isn't it? It's an opinion. Oh, we talk about navigation with a magnet, and it's variable. You can't be sure.
The one thing that's I really find interesting with this work is the integration of all of these different subjects and aspects. I mean, the one thing that really caught my eye with the Golden Thread of Time is that it would have been really easy for you to just write a book explaining the mechanics of the cross, how you constructed it and the like. But you went much further than that. You take the time to explain the solstices and equinoxes. You cover astrology. You look at the historical precedents of this, and you have several different perspectives from authors and researchers in there, which is great. And then you even include some of your own poetry. I mean, if you will, you swing 360 degrees around the Celtic cross and view it from all angles to really hammer home your point. I mean, do you feel like your interest in so many different varying areas and subjects is what allowed you to synthesize all this knowledge into this?
I think I'm a busy person, and I do all sorts of things like sailing, and I play guitar, and I write poetry, and I research, and write books, and I build businesses, and I'm a computer wizard, and
That's what it takes, right?
it takes that, but that's not the answer, because here's I'm going to tell your listeners something which is really important. I left school at the age of 10. I have no formal education past that except what I've learned and read and studied. Now,
Autodidactic, right?
the reason I'm saying that is because, and this is when we started out this conversation, how did you discover it? What are the attributes of discovery? I seriously think that non-formal education when I was a child was the most important contributing factor.
It's so funny that you're saying this, because I just had a conversation with Richard Cassaro, who wrote the book Written in Stone, and we are basically talking about the exact same thing, that the fact that we did not have a formal education is what allowed us to make our own discoveries in all these different areas. So
Yeah, to follow your true self. And
absolutely.
that's why I said that I left school at the age of 10, because anybody who says that you can't achieve because you weren't born in the right place, you didn't have the right family, you didn't go to the right university, you don't have the right letters after your name, talking absolute baloney.
Yeah, it's absolute garbage.
You, if you want to succeed, you want to achieve something, just do it, because you've got a very short life and the Zimmer frame's waiting at the end of it. Do you know what the commonest statement made in a, do you know where people pass at the end of their lives? You know what they call that over in the UK? I don't, do you call it hospices in
Oh,
America?
yeah, I'm sure. Hospices, yep.
The commonest thing ever said in a hospice is this, okay? I wish that I had done what I wanted to do as opposed to trying to please others.
It's the great lesson of life, right?
Yeah. The book I've written isn't just about opening up the past, it's about motivating. You can be motivated if an uneducated old Scot, right, that played around all his life, makes loads of money, can do it. Well, what can I do? But it isn't just about motivation, is it? It's about truth.
Discovery of truth.
The discovery of truth is the most important thing, because in any family, Look, people, people say, well, telling lies is evil. Hey, no, it's not if you're a chameleon. You know, if you're a chameleon, you're going to get eaten by an eagle if you can't change color. Well, that's a good reason to tell lies, isn't it? But it isn't a good reason to tell lies to your own family.
Or to yourself, to lie to yourself.
Well, that's desperate. When you lie to yourself, you're totally lost, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly.
You tell lies to your own family, to the own people that work together. I mean, the Italian name word for family, familia, means where more than one person's gathered together to reach a common goal. Well, I tell you, you bring lies in and you screw trust. And you have got nothing you can build. Your family's going to fall apart. Your business is going to fall apart. Your country's going to fall apart.
Yeah.
Now, I tell you, we've got a world full of lies right now.
So much so that an ounce of truth is like, it's like finding, that the diamond in the rough. I mean, you know what I mean? It's just...
That's right. Now, you go to this, Marty, the most important sign that everybody knows now is the yin-yang symbol. Mm-hmm. It's black, and it's actually based on the spinning serpent, the Ouroboros, the idea of the serpent eating its own tail. It's about draconis.
It's essentially an S, right?
Sure, it's an S, but in the middle of each of it is the opposite of what it is. So if you've got a really dark, black world right now, trust me when I say that time will cause it to become a light one. Mm-hmm. And that's it. It might be dark now, okay, but it's going to be light later. It might be dark in the middle of the night wherever you are right now. It's going to be morning soon.
Yeah, and that's almost like the essence of spiritual work in a way too. It's like almost traveling through the darkness to find that point of white light, if you will.
Yeah, it's simple stuff. You know, one of the things they call about the devil is Set. You know, Set in Egypt. Right. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? It's actually one of the sons of Noah as well. No, not Noah, Adam. Sorry. Mm-hmm. And Set. Okay. Well, that applies very nicely with sunset, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Down goes the sun. Out come the beasts. And you can't see a thing. That's the mass of lies. You can't see where you are because the world's full of lies. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not crazy stuff. That's everything. That's what it is. In the morning, the sun comes up.
Mm-hmm. And when Set occurs and the night comes on, the cross is there to guide you through that night in one respect,
absolutely.
Right?
Now, this is really important. This is now Jesus's ancestor. Okay. Is David, and David wrote the Psalms, and the most important psalm of all is Psalm 23.4. Now, there's two reasons for that, which will give you the truth. And when people say, I don't want to read the Bible because it's full of mumbo jumbo, hey, read the Bible, because if you know what I'm talking about here and you understand the cross and you understand astrology, you can understand the Bible, because 23.4 is the tilt of the angle of the earth. Mm-hmm. Because of precession, is 23.4 degrees. And what it says in there is, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil, because you are with me, and your cross, sorry, your rod, meaning measuring stick, and your staff will comfort me.
And also, the rod or the pole of the earth as well, right?
Well, no, it's rod comes from reed. Reed is a segmented piece of grass. So reed is a rod. Now, you may not know this, Scotland's going for independence at the moment. It may not, it's not the point, but its most important thing is its parliament building is called the Holyrood, and the Queen's house there in Edinburgh is called the Holyrood, and the Holyrood is the name for the Celtic cross. Or the holy measuring stick.
So you have rod, reed, and rood right there. Yeah.
So I'm telling you, Psalm 23.4, written by David, the ancestor of Jesus Christ, according to the Bible, tells you that you will have comfort if you can measure time with the measuring rod and staff.
That's absolutely fascinating stuff, man. Just fantastic.
It's not coincidence, is it?
No, I mean, it's so amazing when you look at this stuff in through these eyes, if you will, how many pieces of the puzzle you can really fit together and how beautiful they come together.
Oh, yeah. This is what they call Occam's razor, or I think they call it exquisite an exquisite mathematical theory, isn't it?
Principle of parsimony. Exactly.
The cross is exquisite mathematics.
Yeah. And once again, right back to that idea of the simplicity of it is what's so beautiful. I mean, even Da Vinci said, the simplicity is the ultimate sophistication.
Sure. Now, I seriously believe, Marty, I don't know. I use the word believe because it means I don't know, because it means by love. It's, yeah, leaf from Old English for love. But I sincerely believe that Da Vinci knew about this. But what would have happened to Da Vinci if he'd said it?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. Just like the rest of them, persecuted, exiled, right?
Oh, worse. You'd have been, I mean, thousands burnt at the stake, tortured.
Yeah.
Thousands. To keep the business alive. But here's the dichotomy of it. Here's the yin and yang. Thank God they kept the business alive, but we wouldn't know this because it's in the stones. It's in your face.
Yeah.
If the church was ever to stand on the day of judgment, he could rightfully turn round to God and say, hey, I'll put it in front of the people. You can see I carved it everywhere. If they can't see it, why am I to blame?
Yeah. Yeah. It's there for the people that have eyes to see it, right?
Sure.
Yeah. You know what? We're, I could talk to you for the next 2 or 3 hours, man, but we are just about out of time here. So, you know, this has been just a fantastic and enlightening conversation, man. Like I said, I really love your work. Yeah, I highly recommend your book to all the listeners. Can you tell us where they can go to get your books and find out more about your work and discoveries?
Yeah, they can get it. If they go to my website, which is crichtonmiller.com, that's www.crichtonmiller.com. You can go to the booksellers from there. But you can go into Google and put Crichton Miller or Crichton E.M. Miller. I think you'll find about 450,000 pages there, which will keep you going. But all of them will direct you either to my Facebook page, where there's a lot of chat goes on that. Of course, it will the Facebook page or Amazon or Gardner's or any of the major booksellers, you can order it through, either as an ebook or as a paperback. And very briefly, I don't know if you looked at this, Marty, but I had to re-release the book because it sold out. And the most money ever paid for the old first edition copy was $8,000 for a signed one.
Oh, wow.
And the second price was $6,000 for a signed one. Now, I thought that was crazy, and I thought, I've got to reissue this book. And so I reissued the book, and I think it cost a couple of, I don't know, $10 or something for the second edition, which is better edited as well.
Well, like I said, you know, I'm enjoying the hell out of it. Like I said, I'm almost done with it, and I'd highly recommend it to all the listeners. So please check this out. Like I said, it's just a fantastic discovery, and I highly recommend and enjoy your work. So much appreciated, man. Have a fantastic day. Go have some bubbly with your family, and maybe we'll talk sometime in the future.
Thanks, Marty, and thanks for asking me on and letting me speak to your listeners. You take care.
All right. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks so much for joining me, everyone. Our outro song is provided by Fred Cusinato and is called A New Earth. Fred is from Canada and plays a mean guitar and is just an all-around good chap. This song was recorded using a tuning of 432 hertz as opposed to the traditional 440 that most guitars are tuned to. You can listen to a bunch of his stuff on reverbnation.com/Fred Cusinato. That's Cusinato. And you can also check out an interview he did with Truth Connections Radio speaking on the importance of 432 hertz. And you can find that just by searching Fred Cusinato on YouTube. Coming up in the next few episodes of the Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour include interviews with the comedy troupe The Joy Camp, author of Astro Music and Tone Color Alchemist Ezra Sanzer Bell, and I'm trying to get Bill Donahue on from HiddenMeanings.com, so send some good vibes out to the universe to hopefully make that happen. Be sure to stay tuned, and always remember, an opinion without pie is just an onion. Thanks. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour. More information about the work of Marty Leeds can be found at MartyLeeds33.com. You can download his full-length studio record, Opus Medico Musica, from iTunes or Amazon.com. And be sure and check out his books, Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1 and 2, and The Peacock's Tales, available at MartyLeeds33.com and Amazon. For hours of free video, check out his YouTube channel at MartyLeeds33. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, or SyncBook Events can be found at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much, and though some people think it's a piece of cake, we all know it's easy as pie.